Hello and welcome to episode 160 of The Crate and Crowbar. My name is Chris Thurston and tonight I'm joined by Philippa Waugh.
Hello.
And Tom Francis.
Hello.
Episode 160. Wow.
Tom's wearing a blazer especially.
Yeah, that's why.
Dressed up.
And Pip's curled up with a blanket because we've all become so terribly old in the course of recording hundreds upon hundreds of hours.
I have a whole water bottle as well.
Yeah. Hot, hot watery takes.
And slippers.
Hot water bottle and cold beer. Or corn beer.
I'm going to have to keep it at arm's length away
from
my
title of
lap.
Pip's debut hip hop.
Notorious PIP. That's when I start using that.
Anyhow, this week in the news, Amazon, who we know have been doing games things or moving in a gamesy direction for a while and hiring people and then not having those people anymore and then hiring them other people and so on. That's how businesses work. have announced at TwitchCon, and I'd forgotten that they own Twitch, so it makes sense that they would announce this at TwitchCon. Three games all at once. One of which called Breakaway, not to be confused with The Biscuit.
Other games called Breakaway?
There's Breakout.
Okay.
Famously. And, anyway. And, one of which Breakaway was in a fit enough state of completion to be shown with a little show match thing and streamed and so on. And the other two, which are called Crucible and New World, were just trailers. But it's kind of interesting. So Breakaway is the pithy way to write a headline about this, should you have to, would be to call it Rocket League of Legends. Which I'm pretty sure was what someone wrote on the whiteboard when they were like, what will make the most money in the world? So it's a 4-on-4 third person actiony mobber, a bit like Smite or something like that in terms of it's how you control it and the abilities and so on, but with a ball in the middle of the pitch that your goal is to get into the goal, into the enemy goal. And it's very physics-y, so there are
this is the same one with like the sort of classical heroes theming, like as a sort of gladiator guy, you know?
Yeah, sorceress. It's also vaguely got like a kind of real mythology theme. So it's like, you know, I mean, it is the same fucking fantasy, steampunky, magic-y sort of post-Blizzard thing that every single game like this does, down to the fact that the characters just look like characters from other games. So they have Spartacus, but he's identical to Mercury from Smite. And they have a pirate woman with a gun, but she's identical to that pirate woman with a gun from League of Legends. And there's a big knight with an axe, I think, and he's identical to Reinhardt from,
pretty strong Reinhardt.
Overwatch. So yeah, so it doesn't look particularly distinctive.
And all those people are also not original in themselves.
No,
the
exactly.
Ones they look like are also good.
A really worn out photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy. So when I first saw it, I, you know, literally rolled my eyes all the way back around until they faced the front again because it looked so derivative. But having watched the show match that they put up, it looks quite fun. You try and, like, if you take any damage, you drop the ball in the air. Or drop into the air, throw into the air. That's how that works. And then someone else can pick it up and take it. You can pass and throw. You can't use your regular abilities when you have the ball, apart from, like, some sort of ball-specific powers. I don't know what that entails. Invulnerability, I hear. and so that's sort of the drama of it. It's like a MOBA team fight, but with a bit of ball play.
Did you ever play
Nasty
Death Ball for UT 2004? Or possibly other UTs?
Yeah.
Because it was that kind of, it was FPS obviously, but, team-based violent, ball sport where it was a similar thing where like, I can't remember what weapon you had if you didn't have the ball, but if you did have the ball, you had no weapons, and then everyone could come and, I think maybe they just had like impact hammers, so everyone could come up and like, jib you. And that was really popular.
Yeah. So, I mean, it has that feeling to it, actually. I think if, that sort of cool total conversion kind of look. And there are a few other interesting ideas in it. So you can, your team has a stock of buildables, which is their awkward way of saying, things, not quite buildings, but not like, you know, power ups either. that you can put on the map, which are like things that fire, like a rolling explosive barrel that trundles towards the enemy base, or traps or ramps that give you speed boosts and stuff. And that's sort of a series of strategic decisions. They persist between rounds. So it sounds quite interesting. It sounds very, very, very spectator friendly, because it combines the spectator friendliness of a MOBA team fight with the spectator friendliness of a game of football.
Yeah. They make a big deal of this with all three games, I think. Mention some kind of like, it's this, but also has like native Twitch integration, and it's designed for spectators and designed to be as much fun to watch as it is to play.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're really leaning hard on that, essentially, on creating esports out of the gate. So initially, one of the other reasons I rolled my eyes is because they came out saying, we're making an esport, which is obviously bollocks. But the fact that they're making a game that's obviously very spectator-friendly is not an illegitimate pursuit.
Is it obviously bollocks because you don't sort of get to decide whether your thing becomes an esport or not?
It's like saying I've made a viral joke.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Like, yeah, it's like you can say you made a joke, but you can't decide if it became viral.
Yeah,
like exactly. That's the thing. The second game, it's called Crucible, and
this is all my friend Kate's working on.
And it's a shooter, So you've got to think, right? If you think about games that have been mega popular on Twitch in the last couple of years, you've got Rocket League and MOBAs combined in the first one. The second one is a competitive survival shooter on an alien planet. So it's somewhere between Ark and, sounds a bit like Evolve actually, but hopefully not rubbish. And so the idea is it's 6v6 by default, but only one player can win. So eventually teams can break down and stuff, and people can kind of, you know, murder each other or whatever. And they haven't said much about it other than that, except that there's a spot in any given game for a 13th player who controls the environment and sort of makes things happen, which is presumably the sort of like, I can imagine, they haven't confirmed this, but I can imagine that being the sort of role that just gets given over to Twitch.
Yeah.
Like if you have like Twitch chat voting on like, I don't know, release the hounds or something in a sort of Hunger Games-y battle royale situation, that seems like, again, mega money.
Yeah. I only read the one sentence that I could find on their website, about it, which was, it was a battle to the death, which is like, okay, so it's a game. And I guess in a multiplayer context, that means people don't respawn, at least within a round. And then it said, and one player is they described it as like the broadcaster and the controller of these things. So they're obviously sort of thinking that this would be the person who's streaming it if it is a person. And, naturally Twitch plays is an obvious route for them to go as well.
Incidentally, a kind of a fun, problem for Amazon is, they've actually, so you know the thing we always lament when like games have completely ungoogleable names because they've called their game like Volume, for example. And if you search for Volume or even Volume Game, you just get like, how do I fix the volume in my games?
Endings are especially hard ones to find.
Amazon have given them an extra problem because if you search for Crucible, you don't get it. And if you search for Amazon Crucible, you get all of the DVDs for various versions of Arthur Miller's The Crucible or the book, or because it'd be interesting that like when Google starts making games, they have the same problem where you can't Google anything they've made because you get sort of like recursive search.
I think Google just ignores the word Google. Just assumes you're like 80 and trying to search for something by typing the, like telling Google to search for it.
That's not inaccurate.
Also, the added complication that if you search for Crucible Game, you'll probably end up with Destiny's PvP. Like, if you search for, you know, Crucible Deathmatch, like, that's a thing in Destiny.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So.
The band Love are also very hard to search for. Because anything to do with Love, like Love band, Love, Group Love, Song, Love Song.
Yeah, things you don't think of at the time, but yeah. Saw a Love in concert a few years ago. Many years ago.
They're very good.
Teenager. Yeah, they're very good. Anyway, that's irrelevant. The third and final game they've announced is called New World. And the only really image they've released is of a grim-looking conquistador with blood pouring out of his eyes or something. And it's set in a 17th century sort of mythologized version of colonial America. So there are, you know, Native American tree spirits and you know, forest monsters and stuff like that. But otherwise, it's again a survival game, but a persistent one, an MMO, where players build towns and settlements and stuff in a sort of dynamic way. Which again,
how racist is it going to be?
That's a good question. And the one that, you know,
there'll be a slider for that.
The one that occurred to me is that they'd picked a sort of a bit of a problematic territory for a game about, you know, taming the wilderness and building towns and stuff, because famously that involved a lot of genocide. And so where Ark has dinosaurs, this has, you know, the creatures of the belief system of the peoples that you are explicitly annihilating. So, I mean, I don't know to what extent that bears true of the game or how heavily mythologized it is. I mean, hopefully it's fictionalized to the point where those associations are less pertinent, but given that their, you know, title image is a grim conquistador, doesn't really seem like they're not going to feature that.
Maybe no. We'll explore them in interesting or thought-provoking ways. We've got so much faith in
them. Yeah, yeah.
But it just sounds funny when you say it in reference to video games.
Well, as we all know, games are art and capable of handling historical, delicate subject matter with aplomb.
Did anybody play or see anything of Choice Chamber?
No.
It's a game that is designed for Twitch where it's kind of a side-on platformer, but it's built to be played with the kind of Twitch Plays input. And the idea is the people watching you play all vote on what's going to happen next, or like something that will change the way it plays. So they can vote for like modifiers, like you have a giant head or enemies do double damage or that kind of thing. But they also, puzzles will directly involve the audience. So like, there'll be some red blocks and some blue blocks and some green blocks, and the green blocks in your way. And so you're asking Twitch chat to vote green so that it'll move the green blocks, and then they'll vote red and the red block comes down and crushes you. And so that's like a sort of interesting preview of how that that role might play out in these games that are designed for it.
It's kind of how reality TV ends up going sometimes. Like, you know, I think Big Brother has had seasons where the audience sort of dictate particular things, like not to any great extent, but you know, sort of there's still a you choose what happens next, or they've had like live TV event night kind of things where they're dicking around with new technology or something, and you know, the audience gets to kind of choose the outcome of particular things. So it's kind of interesting that it's found its home in gaming.
Twitch beat a grandmaster at chess recently, apparently. A Twitch community did. Presumably a very chess-savvy Twitch community.
Or one with, like, the wiki open.
I should say the grandmaster won, but they won one of the games.
Yeah.
So it was, like, the best of three or something, or maybe the best of five.
But, like, imagine if you're all just sat at home Googling, you know, like, what the best move can be.
Yeah, I wondered. I haven't looked at the game, but I almost wondered if it was one of those things where, like, a grandmaster is brilliant at outwitting grandmasters.
Yeah.
And when you have, like, you're facing an opponent who probably doesn't even know what they just did.
Well, it's like how if you play poker against someone who doesn't understand poker, then you can't read them because they don't know what they've done. Or even, you know, like, if a pro MOBA player tries to play against like terrible players, sometimes they'll get caught out because they're like, no sensible person would even be there right now, and you're just like, hi.
I've learned from my experience of playing with like high level Dota coaches and stuff that they can't really follow. All of their instincts go away when they play at Dumpo normal person level, because they're like, oh, those people that, you know, they're missing from the map. They're clearly doing this strategy in this particular way, and they'll be appearing from the fog of war here in 10 seconds. And in another version of the game, he'd be completely correct. But in this one, it's like, actually, no, they just got lost on the way back from the base.
They're trying to walk through a tree.
And they're having an argument, and now they don't know where they are.
And they're all in mid now.
Yeah, exactly.
Because why not?
And two of them have left. The other thing I was going to say about New World is, of the three, it sounds like the game that probably is the most Clint Hawking-y. Given that he worked for them for a while. He's not there anymore, is he?
Yeah, no.
No,
he's back at Ubisoft.
It's just another episode in the Where is Clint Hoyle right now sort of minigame.
But, like, you know, given that that's not one of the games they announced, Find Clint, of the three, that sounds like the one that the sort of open world sandboxy survival MMO seems like the one that would be the best fit for his sensibility. So,
and Kim Swift is the other big name that they hired. I think she's still there, isn't she?
I think she is, yeah. I think so, yeah.
So yeah, I wonder which of those she's working on.
Do not know. But still, that's the, that was my thought. That was all of my thought. That's the entire thing.
I think the only thing that I'm left thinking about just at the moment without having seen, you know, footage yet, cause I was just not looking. Then I'm sort of just left wondering whether football is technically just a really bouncy payload delivery game.
Yeah, potentially. Like, well, the thing it reminded me of is there's,
it's just a little escort mission for balls.
Yeah. What is football if not escorting balls?
It's just, yeah, you're just trying to get a payload down the pitch.
Yeah.
To the goal.
I mean, Jeremy Lin, the basketball player, who's a big Dota fan, made that case that basketball is the most useful sport to understand what Dota is. which is a complicated analogy we'll get into because we'll get complaints. But to be honest, this combination of getting a ball down a pitch and hitting each other with magical spells is quite close to my understanding of the game basketball, which is derived entirely from the film Space Jam. So yeah, nonetheless. Speaking of prime Twitch appealing internet online video computer battle games, Pip.
Hello.
What have you been playing?
Well, I was going to say Burly Men at Sea, but I'm assuming.
No, we don't. Oh.
I mean.
Segue went off the bridge there.
Yeah, I'm very sorry.
That's okay. Just,
well, I've played 20 minutes of Battle Right, if that helps.
Well, we can talk about that, then we can talk about Burly Men at Sea. How did you find Battle Right for 20 minutes?
Really stressful.
It is.
It's the sort of game that distills all of the elements of Dota that I'm not very good at and makes them into a separate game where I'm not allowed to just sort of be a support or tank things or, you know, I have to permanently be agility, damage, dealy, nonsense.
Jumpy, flippy.
Trying to work out where my hands are on the keyboard at any given time. So, yeah, and more than four abilities is just far too many. And, no.
Was the tutorial effective at all at making you feel at home?
Well, it taught me a character and I have a sense of how the game works and it was enough to look at it from the vantage point of having played thousands of hours of other games in that genre and go, I see what you're doing. But it was also enough for me to go, and I will never be good at this. I will be, you know, I will probably be mediocre at this enough that I can play with some friends who are very good and then they can sort of enjoy saying, did you see that? And I will say, yes, well done.
Well, one cool
and
thing.
Be pleased for them.
One thing you might enjoy about Battle Royale is it's unlike other games like that because its fog of war system extends to your teammates as well. So if they are behind a wall, you can't see them. You don't get that thing of sharing their line of sight along with your own.
Yes, but you've got shadow play, so then you'll upload the GIF and share it with me anyway.
Well, I mean, I will. But what I'm saying is generally, if you're playing with insufferable friends, who are always, you know, telling you to check this out. Look what I'm about to do.
No,
you
I wasn't saying they were insufferable. I was just saying that I would, that's my role in those games is to be pleased for them and then move on and play Adventure Capitalist, which I'm very good at.
What I'm saying is Battle Royale is unique in that it gives you the opportunity to defiantly hide and refuse to see what they're doing.
Cower.
I just thought that might appeal to you. Not cowering, defiantly hiding.
Yes, I can hide. That's a thing I can do. Okay. Very good at hiding. I'm not very good at hiding.
You're terrible at hiding.
Yeah.
You giggle when you think you've hid successfully, which is the biggest weakness.
When my niece plays hide and seek, she insists on telling you where to hide.
Yes!
She'll dictate exactly where you must hide, and you're allowed to hide anywhere else. Then she'll go off and count, and then come and look for you.
I don't know if I told this story on the podcast before, but once I left the living room, came back in, only to find that the sofa, which is sort of on the same wall as the door, had moved, clearly moved, about 2 feet into the room, towards me. And Pip had vanished. And what could have possibly happened? And
I wasn't expecting your depth perception to be as, as keen as it apparently is.
Using both eyes.
This really would have confused a pirate. But then the thing that really gave it away was the hee hee coming from the far side of the clearly moved sofa.
Oh.
And then the other side of the top of Pip's head popping up and down because she was giggling. So not a strong point.
No. My niece would have struggled with that one. If she didn't tell you to go there, she wouldn't expect you to be there.
See, I just need to play more with her and then I win. But yeah.
So that's about all right.
Well, yeah, I mean, and the thing is, like, I can clearly appreciate that. The thing that's slightly galling is I had the same reaction that you had to the Amazon thing when I got the email basically saying, hey, look, it's an arena MOBA thing that might well be an eSport. And I was just like, oh, God, another one of these things. I think I said so quite publicly as well. And then it was like, and now everyone really likes it. It's at the top of the Steam charts and it's actually a really good game. It looks like with a high skill ceiling and quite likely to succeed should it go down the esports route. God damn it.
It does make an interesting case that if you are an indie studio building a game like that, and we talked last week about how there are lots of studios making small, well, not small, but focused multiplayer games. It's probably quite a bad idea to adopt that kind of post Blizzard art style now. Like, because it's obviously been mega successful, and everyone's mimicking League of Legends as well, specifically. But, holy shit, as someone who might feature this game on the website, I'm bored of putting, like, I have three panels to populate on the front of my part of the website, and I hate it when all three of them look like exactly the same game. When it's like a barbarian man with an axe charging in three different directions for three different games, that's when it's like, I had that this week.
I don't know, you could have a triptych, a really lovely sort of, you know, movement-centric thing. But I would say that, to be honest, Battlerite did fine without my endorsement. So. Mm.
Oh, yeah, absolutely can work. But I'm just being both selfish and self-aggrandizing by assuming that my approval or disapproval of things. But I would say that, you know, Fractured Space came along and maybe drew some eyes that it wouldn't otherwise because it's the theme is different. It's not that sort of thing. Like, I had people looking over my shoulder going, like, what's that? Spaceship game. And I would say, it's a MOBA, and they would go, shit, and then leave. So, yeah. But at least they got them that far.
Yeah, that's true. I think I'm just sort of done with generic, sort of that medieval fantasy world, you know? Like, I'm fine with lots of other things, but just that, you know, yeah, slightly cartoonish, non-specific kind of elves and dwarves and blah, 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 you know? Because you know how I feel about Tolkien anyway. So yeah. Anything that's too referential of budget Lord of the Rings is a bit, you know, and I'll get beyond it if it's a good game, but it's one of those things that, I don't know if anyone else has this, but, you know, particular art styles just don't do it for me. So the game has to really work a little bit harder.
Mm.
Like pixel art games, like I don't get on with that art style at all. And so, if that's someone's main selling point, like the unique thing is that it has pixel art, it's kind of a lot harder to get further into the description and go, okay, but what are you really doing with this?
Having put Battlerite to bed, tell us about Burly Men.
Burly Men at Sea is lovely.
What is Burly Men at Sea?
So it's a storytelling, seafaring, adventure-y game where you have three brothers, the brothers Beard, and they find an empty sea chart in a bottle, and they then proceed to head out into the waters, into the open ocean, and see what they can see to fill in the chart. And it's absolutely lovely. The art style is really, it's a kind of Scandinavian type, clean lines, you know, quite bright, fresh palette. And the I hope I don't butcher their names, but Brooke and David Condalera? I really hope I've got that right. Who make up the studio Brain and Brain, just have this really lovely sense of the whole game is this gorgeous sense of storytelling through, images and animations and, you know, just lovely sound effects. Like there's, a lady rolling bread. And I think that the sound of the rolling pin is, just someone sort of making little noises with their mouth. You know, it's like that kind of slightly, I guess rustic sound effects, you know what I mean? Like it's not high.
Artisanal Foley.
Yeah, I guess. But it's just this wonderfully, polished, but also accessibly charming thing. Mm. And it's got a lot of replay value. So it lets you sort of, once you finish one adventure, you can head out on another one and choose different pathways and things. And either you can sort of go down some of the same route that you've done before, and like the dialogue changes on that second visit, like because they remember that they've been there before. I mean, it doesn't change again beyond that, I don't think, but like it's just a sweet kind of, oh, you're playing it again kind of reward. And then also you can just sort of choose to do different things, like I got eaten or swallowed by a whale, and you can either sort of wait it out and sail out of his mouth, or you can tickle his epiglottis and get splurted out through his blowhole, which I think David Attenborough might have things to say about that, but it works in the context of the game. And so you can kind of like explore different things, you know, you sort of find, you can have a race, you can find a troll, you can, you know, do all of these things. But the stories don't outstay their welcome, and it's just really lovely. I'd love to play it with, my little niece and just sort of see what she makes of it, really, because it feels so much like a children's storybook made digital.
Mm.
So I just, really loved it. I played it through about 6 times, I think.
Wow. How long is it? Little...
Oh, it's not long at all. I think a playthrough takes about like half an hour, maybe.
Right.
Maybe less than that. But yeah, so it's just really charming. And I would thoroughly recommend that people pick it up, even just sort of as a demonstration of how to make the art side of things work as well, because there's little... animations and effects that really complement the action on screen. Like it's highly stylized, but like, just to mention the whale again, simply because I don't want to mention too many things because it's only a little game. So, you know, you don't want to ruin too many of the surprises, but if you go out of its blowhole, it's like this, really stylized fountain effect against a white background, with the little brother's beard sort of spewing up into the air off these little curly dotted lines that represent the water. And if you wait it out, then the screen where the text is that tells you that you're sailing out basically, suddenly has like a triangular opening appear as if the mouth is opening. Like you didn't realize that the text page was the whale, but you know, it becomes it, and then the ship sails out across that, and it's just really cool.
Where is it available?
I believe it is on Steam and other places like that. So I think it's on like Humble and things like that, but it might also be on mobile as well, which I think might work. Yeah, so I think Android and, Google Play and iOS, because they also did a previous game called Doggins, which was similarly adorable.
Did we play a bit of that?
We did play a little bit of that.
Hmm.
And then I got sleepy and stuck, so I went to sleep. But yeah, so I thought that was brilliant.
Nice.
Hmm.
Good. Tom. What have you noticed?
I've been playing a lot of one thing and a little bit of many things. And so you'll get partly Tom's brief impressions of things he's not given a chance yet. actually, I did that on Hitman for the Bangkok part, and I played that a bit more now.
Just in time for the fifth part to come out.
Yeah, I can't keep up with it. It's too fast. I still don't really still not really clicking with Bangkok. I have given it more of a chance now. Like, I probably played it for like an hour and a half or maybe 2 hours. And I played it through three times. My first time I got a score of 0 out of 5. My second and third times I got a score of 1 out of 5. And my second time, I don't even know why. Like, I did get recorded and I meant to go back and get the tape and I forgot to go back and get the tape. So that's fair enough. But apparently I was spotted. Apparently bodies were found. Apparently all this other stuff that I don't remember happening. So that kind of sucks. Third time I know full well why everyone saw me. It was because I did the first target really well and did like an accidental kill, which I think even prevents the body counting as a body found, like if it's an accident. And then I was good, going to do the second target, which is the lawyer, and there are loads of different opportunities, and I tried a few of them that I didn't like, and then there was one that's like, bring him up to his suite, and you have to dress as a bellboy to do it, and once you get there, he wants you to clean the whole place, and like go around and like, sweep up stains and stuff, and I wasn't willing to do that, and I'd already extremely pissed off with it, because it's one of those, you tell him, oh, your room's ready, follow me. And then you walk to his room, and then he just stops because you walked too fast for him. And he walks at half your speed for some reason. And if you get more than 5 meters away, he stops. And then if you go back to him, you then have to talk to him again. And then you have a whole conversation where he's irritated with you and says, oh, did you bring a map this time? Because like, you got lost last time. When in fact, it was just him failing to follow you. And when you go up the stairs, if you go more than like 3 meters ahead of him, he stops because he can't find you. And then if you go with like 2 meters next to him, he stops because he thinks you stopped. And so it's like, you have to stay at the exact right way to get him to go upstairs. And then he finally gets there. You also want to be cleaning the apartment. And I'm just like, fuck this. I'd already saved like 3 different times so that I could just shoot him 9 times with my pistol just to like relieve the stress of doing this. And then eventually I'm like, no, this is just canon. I'm just going to hit him with a wrench and snap his neck right now and just sprint out of the building. And that was how I did it.
Wow.
And then I also played a little bit of Stellaris, which I had been really looking forward to. And I didn't play it at launch because I'd heard there was potential mid-game issues, like 1 out of 5 reviewers. I think a fair few reviewers mentioned some kind of like sluggishness in the mid-game where you couldn't declare war for this reason, or you couldn't get through someone's territory or whatever. And then they specifically addressed that in like one big patch. So I was waiting for that and it happened while I was away. And I spent about 45 minutes designing my custom race, and that part is really good and I really enjoyed it. You get to design like, if you pick what they look like out of all these different categories, there's like mammalian, reptilian, avian, molluscoid, I think, and fungal. And there's like, you know, 20 different versions of each of those things. And I spent ages picking which one was my favorite out of those. And I went for, I think, a molluscoid with like a very fruity, big purple tentacle head, which I was very pleased with. And then you like pick who your leader is and what they look like, what clothes they're wearing. You pick what genetic traits your species has, like predispositions towards different mindsets and stuff. Then you pick your politics, and it has this really complicated like wheel or sort of star diagram where things like military and pacifist are obviously opposites, and individualist and collectivist are opposites, and materialist and spiritualist are opposites. And you get to pick like how far along each of those axes you want to be. And you can only specify like you only have a certain number of points to spend. So you basically, I think I was I was a little bit individualist, a little bit materialist, and a little bit, pacifist maybe. Yeah. I wanted to be like a race of, kind of artist kind of people who are like very cultured and civilized and just happen to be immensely strong as well, because I saw that one of the genetic traits you can get is very strong, which gives you like a 40% bonus to your army strength, which I think, I never got this far, but I think that probably doesn't count for like ship battles. I think it's when you invade someone's planet, like once you actually land your troops, how good are your troops?
You wonder how useful
being physical strong strength in space.
Would be in high tech.
I can really press that fire button.
Yeah.
I really like the idea of you roaming around as this like super beefy theatre troupe.
Yeah, exactly. That was what got me excited about it. It was like, I just went all down the culture route and was just making it like really sophisticated, like, sort of free thinking, people. And then I was just thinking, like, looking at the degenerates and thought, man, it'd be funny if we were strong. It'd be funny if just like, we seem like pacifists. And then if we actually come to, if it gets to the point where you do attack us and we have to fight back, you just find out, shit, these guys are like 80 foot tall.
I'm just imagining sort of like molluscoid Victorian touring strongmen. Exactly.
And then you start the game and then you realize that the sort of like, I mean, I was playing with all the tutorials on, so that kind of adds a lot of flavor text that is obviously generic to everyone. And it really couldn't have been further from the race that I'd imagined, you know, like it's all stuff that's completely inevitable and I could have foreseen, but like your race has to actually be really excited about technology and researching things and exploring space and settling on new worlds. That's what your race is, because it has to be, because that's what the game is.
The game
so is. All this stuff that you made up about who your race are and what they want and what they, how they feel and stuff is kind of, maybe it's relevant like 20 hours in when you start to have, you know, diplomatic relations with everyone and stuff, but basically the early game is just going to be galsive. And it's also just incredibly slow. And like for some reason, just researching the technology you need to colonize. I knew I wasn't going to play much, and I knew I just wanted to get my feet wet. Dip my toes in and get my feet wet.
It's like a complicated splashing motion. Maybe you sort of scoop and dip. both.
I just wanted to like settle one planet or something and just see what that was like. And for some reason, the technology you need to do that just takes months and months to research. So I'd researched like a few basic things leading up to that, and then that one just kept on going and going and going. And then once I finally got it, building a colony ship is also like wildly expensive, like 5 times more expensive than anything else you can build at that point. And I built that, I set it building, and then I was saving up for it, and because it costs a huge amount of upfront money, even though it's also going to take time to build. So I had to like redesign my, economy of my home planet to make more money. And you don't have a lot of options for that. I do really like the way it's a bit like Civ where you get to choose where your people are. You say like, I want a person on this tile and a person on this tile and a person on that tile. And I can't fill them all, but those are the ones that produce the most gold and the most food or whatever. And I did that, like shuffled them around a bit to make more money so I could afford the ship sooner, which meant I was losing energy credits for a while. But I had a lot in reserve, so that was fine. And then it took so long to save up for the ship that I'd just about run out of energy credits when I did it. And then as soon as it was built, for some reason that puts you in massive energy credit deficit. Like you suddenly start losing energy credits hugely just because this colony ship exists. Like it's just by existing. It's like in my breakdown, it was said that colonization was costing me like 50 energy credits a month or whatever, which is way more than I could possibly afford. And also when you're in negative energy credits, that means you can't now, like your other resources are all hampered by like 50%. So you can't gain those other resources. So you also can't afford to take any off those. And basically like it's like a Supreme Commander style economy crash where the fact that you fucked up means you can't recover from fucking up. And so it just took ages for me to like get out of that slump and then finally settle on a new world. And I was really excited about it because like it's quite rare to find any habitable worlds in this other system. There was a couple that were habitable, but one of them we found life on it, like a sort of wild beast, and it was the first alien life we'd ever found, and our people were really excited about this. I knew that there was like the special like space stations you build to like monitor primitive alien life so you can like help them become spacefaring and stuff, and I was excited to do that. But it turned out this wasn't the right kind of life for that. And then when I settled, I thought, well, at least there'll be like some kind of like encounter with them or something, like these weird alien dogs. But there wasn't. And eventually it's just like you can research technology to clear them out. Nothing interesting happened when I colonized a new planet, and I realized I zoomed out at this point. I was playing on a small galaxy. The default was medium, and I intentionally went one smaller. And I zoomed out, and I'm on like a ring of stars, a ring-shaped galaxy. And it's just like the star system I've explored are just like 1% of 1% of it. It's just like mind-boggling and huge. And I just thought, I don't have the energy for this. I would need to be so much more excited about this to spend the amount of time it's going to take to get anywhere with it. And it's not like I'm not the right kind of gamer because I play Galsiv like crazy. But I feel like that had more life in the early game. Like it was just quicker to get started and quicker to do something. And you immediately hit your first neighboring race and you would have tense relations with them. There'd be like, you would just see there's this class 14 world right between you and you have to get that first. Like, it's life or death. If they get that first, it's going to be so upsetting. Cause that's a really, really lush world that will have loads of, make loads of money and, be really productive. And so there was always this like tension and drama and excitement all the way through Galsiv. And I didn't get that at all here. And also it really bothered me that space is not contiguous. So you can see your solar system and all the planets in it, which is actually really hard to see. Like, planets are absolutely tiny because they've sort of gone for semi-realistic proportions. And also your ships are tiny. You can't, like, I was frantically scrolling out to try and see the whole galaxy, and you can't do that. You just get capped, and then you have to click on a galaxy map button, which then switches you to a map view. Mm. And when you're in the local view, you can't sort of pan over to the next solar system. You're also just locked into this star, so you have to kind of click arrows that skip you to the next solar system. Mm. So it's really just like a whole array of little nodes all over. So it doesn't have that feel of, like, continuous space, which it's not mechanically important. I don't want to do anything in the space between the stars. But it just makes it feel less like a place to me. It just feels like a menu, basically.
Mm. Time to shame. Go home and write poetry and lift.
Yeah.
Might be worth looking up whether there's, like, any ways around it. Because I find with those kinds of games that, I mean, obviously you've probably spent more time playing them than I have, and I get very frustrated and leave. That length that you're talking about in the early game of waiting, like, is there a chance that there's another thing that makes the on-ramp to that, the thing that was taking up the time, less awful? As in, was there any intermediary technology to research in order that the other thing wouldn't have taken as long?
I think it was pretty much straight off the bat. You research three things at once for some reason, and that was one of them, I think. And my other branches all finished much quicker than this one. So, like, I can't remember what they are, but, like, social technology. I researched a couple of those before the colonization one would research. Huh. And I was also, you can control the game speed, but I was playing on fastest for most of it. I'm actually really excited about Endless Space now, which is me not learning my lesson.
But the sequel's out very, very soon.
Yeah, sorry, that's what I meant. Endless Space 2, because did it just go into early access, or it's about to go into early access? There was a piece on RPS that I think was an early access review, but also it's not in early access yet. I think sort of like an advanced access to early access.
Like an alpha, kind of. Maybe a closed alpha thing, maybe?
Yeah, which is Adam Smith, and he was saying, I already knew kind of what is special about them. I remember in the first one, there's like a race where everyone's a clone of this one person. Mm. And that's what I want from these games, I think. My favorite stuff in Galsiv was all the just nutty stuff. Like, there was one of the races, when they added an expansion that kind of gave the races their own tech trees, one of them who'd always been like a very hostile and unfriendly race, they had an alternative colony ship that instead of colonizing the world just murders every single person on it and makes it unusable for everyone forever.
like
a genocide ship. And stuff like that I really enjoy. And so apparently in Endless Space 2, there's one race, I think called the Cravers, who are just, they're automatically at war with everyone. They can't ever make peace. And they, I think they sort of have to eat other people to survive. They have to just constantly be consuming or they'll die. Like, they're just naturally dying at all times, and so they have to just murder constantly, which is great. And then there's space parasites who they can make peace and start at peace with everyone, but they also have to leech people's souls as their, like, primary resource, and they can do that to someone even when they're not at war with them. And the other people know they're doing it, and they can declare war in response, but, like, these guys don't have to be the ones to declare war. It's just like, oh, this is just how we do business. We're just going to suck your souls out for a while, which is kind of awesome. Wow. I think that's what I want, is just like, because the races in, I don't know how they play in the actual fullness of the game, but in Stellaris, I felt like I designed this race with loads of personality, and then the game was just like, well, now you're a faction in space, and so is everyone else.
Yeah, especially when you offer that much freedom, it's really difficult to provide huge consequences for it.
Yeah. I also finally finished Mankind Divided, which was kind of a slog. Like, just, I was really enjoying it, most of it, but it was just so fucking long. It must have taken me like 45 hours to finish.
Hmm.
And I think partly, it's obviously one of those games where you can do the side quests or not, and if you don't, then it's much quicker. But the structure of it, I felt, was almost forcing me to do the side quests, because every time you go on a mission, it says, oh, when you leave, any of these side quests might be cancelled forever, so go and finish those first. And the ones I'm kind of in the middle of, I feel like I've got to finish those, and then if there's any that I've kind of heard about that sound halfway interesting, I've kind of got to do those. And then later on it starts to tell you, like, oh, every single side quest you have will be forever gone if you don't do them now. Mm. And so it just kind of pressured me into doing them, and they are relatively fun, most of them. Like, they're things I would do, but I wanted to break them up with combat. Like, most of them don't involve any combat at all, and the main draw of Deus Ex for me is this, like, beautifully interconnected maze-like webs of vents and security systems, and slowly picking my way through those and silently taking people out. And I just wanted, like, a little bit of that between the side quests, and it was just saying, nope, you can't do that. You have to do all the side quests one after the other, then you get to do the mission. So that structure really didn't work that well for me. I also, like, I had problems with the story, which I think I talked about before, where it just didn't grip me at all, and I, to the point where it was so boring I couldn't follow it. Like, I couldn't understand it because it would slip out of my brain as soon as they'd said something, and I had to, like, I have shadow play running where you can, like, record the last 5 minutes, and after a cutscene, I had to hit the record last 5 minutes button, alt tab out, and watch it again and say, like, well, what were you saying? Oh, Brown. Who's Brown? I can't remember who Brown is.
Welcome
is he pro-org
to my
or anti-org?
World. It's like this all the time.
And that didn't really get better by the end. There were individual, like, side quests that where I could follow the story, because and there was just, like, this has been said elsewhere, I think, but there's a side quest where you investigate murder, and it's kind of been held up as the best side quest in the game. And it's not great. Like, it's got a really schlocky twist and a very, very dumb ending for me, at least. But it was way more compelling than the main plot, because it was just a murder. Someone's been killed, and you investigate how they were killed and what's going on. And it's so easy to relate to that. It's so easy to get interested in that. Like, I do want to know how they were killed. I do want to know why their orgs were ripped out. And, oh, there's, like, fragments of an EMP grenade at this site. That's interesting. I wonder what's going on there. And that was just, like, almost like a lesson in, like, here's how you make a plot interesting, like, on a very small scale. And if they just started with something like that, I could have got way more into it. I do think the actual, like, level spaces are better than they've ever been. Like, they're really, really interconnected and complicated and cool. And I really loved picking my way through most of them. I was amused to find when I finished the game that I also got the achievement for not killing anyone, because this is amusing, because early on in the game, I had been incredibly principled about this. I hadn't done this before, but I was like, just never use a lethal weapon, always tase people or trank dart them or punch them. And hide the bodies and stuff. And then, like, I got to some boss and he said, oh, I can't believe you killed all of my people, and you're such a monster. And so I had, like, an argument with him about that, and I never really found out why he thought I'd done that. And then someone back at base said, like, I'd had a mission where I had to slip past the police to get somewhere, and I tased a couple of them, as you do. And she was like, oh, I can't believe you took out all those cops. And, like, I don't think she said it conclusively, but she was phrasing it as if I killed police officers to get this done. And like, Jensen's response is like, oh, this is just like casualties of war, and this has to be done. And my only options were just like angrily justify killing police, which I hadn't done. And after that, I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to keep tasing people and tranking people because it's kind of like my play style, but I'm not going to worry if anyone dies now. I'm like, if I can turn a turret to my side and it mows everyone down, that's just fine. And I did that a whole bunch of times. And there's a great bit where you're not quite sure the allegiance of, like, you're in a building with security who are supposed to be on your side, but everyone's a little bit suspicious. And if you just keep going, then you find out for sure whether they're on your side or not. But I just, like, you can already climb into vents and you can already go into locked doors and stuff. So I snuck through a vent and found their security room. And I just thought, I'm just going to turn your robot against you. Let the robot sort it out. And the robot just, like, killed all of them. And it was fantastic because you can, like, watch through the computer through the robot's eyes and see it, like, have this huge battle, or you can come out of the computer and then just, like, watch through the window. So, like, guns people down and they'll scream in panic and throw grenades at it and stuff. And they'll, like, throw an EMP grenade and disable it for a while, and then it will wake back up and start mowing them down again. And it takes like 10 minutes to happen. And then, yeah, at the end of the game, it says, oh, well done, you didn't kill anyone.
It's like, the robot did.
But technically, I guess I didn't kill anyone. But also, that means I even more don't know what the fuck all those NPCs were talking about, because like three different NPCs strongly, either outright stated or strongly hinted that I'd killed people.
Oh, so then you killed some people.
Well, so all those three were talking before I started doing this. So okay, really, so, as far right. as I know,
like,
I really
what it yeah, but to make it interesting that what it does and doesn't count as killing people seems to be like tasing people, that counts.
Yeah.
Getting a robot to kill everybody, that doesn't.
Yeah, maybe if I'd had robots kill everyone early on, they would have been cooler with it. I mean, it's all just, it could be a malfunction. You don't know, I hacked it.
No, but the achievement system does, that's the point.
Yeah. There is a note in that achievement. I specifically called out not just the fact that you had to kill bosses in Human Revolution, but in my review I mentioned that there's an achievement that says for not killing anyone except bosses. And I said something like, you know, it says in the achievement thing, it says, don't kill anyone, bosses don't count. And I said something like, bosses do count, actually. There's still people like this is bullshit. And then the achievement for not killing anyone in Mankind Divided is complete the game without killing anyone, in brackets, bosses are people too.
Awesome.
Also, I totally killed the boss, but I killed him with robots, so.
Doesn't count for the robots. The NRA yeah. have a really specific thing about that.
But then, so I really wonder if it's also possible to kill a boss with a kill switch, which in Deus Ex 1, that was like a word that you said to someone, but in Deus Ex 5, I guess we're on 4, it is just a literal switch. You find the button that kills him, so you just bring that to the fight and then you just press the button and kill him.
Why would that button exist?
Thank God we changed that to a word.
They were giving these people like really powerful orcs, and so they wanted the ability to like shut them down. And then I guess if they're like behind enemy lines or something, you also want to destroy all technology so that they can't be salvaged by the enemies. I don't know. I never actually found this button, but I wonder if that counts as a kill. Because the button did it. Just press exactly. the button. Like, where is the ethical line?
If you're
going to
go with that, then you seriously end up in the, but my gun did it.
Yeah.
The autonomous chisels in my arms did it. Yeah, I mean, you know, that's where it gets into the real robo-futures, you know, philosophy, where it's like, well, what if I don't actually really have arms? Because Adam Jensen, he doesn't have arms. He lost his arms at the start of Human Revolution. So is he really
accountable? Two robots did it.
Two robots
attached to my body.
Two robots attached to another body.
But he still has hands, doesn't
no.
he?
No. He's basically just most hands. Some of a torso and a head.
But, like, he looks like he's got hands.
That's the magic of
he's
orgs.
He's got fingers.
Yes, they're robot fingers.
They're, like, black and metal.
Yeah. I thought he was just wearing gloves.
No, he's almost all robot.
Like, Wolverine kind of augmentation.
He keeps breaking his whiskey glass because of his super strong fingers.
Whiskey glasses are quite thick.
Mm.
Can he hold a champagne flute?
No, almost certainly not.
Okay. No, can he hold a child?
No. Probably shouldn't.
I think it's like he doesn't have maybe like a sense of touch to the same extent, so he can't tell how hard he's squeezing things.
But like, there are sensors for that.
Yeah,
people
it wouldn't be
have
hard.
Sensors that tell you like whether your car is about to back into another car. Surely you could get that for fingers.
Beep, beep.
You know, like, oh,
you're crushing this child.
You're just grazing it, you know. It's fine. Like, you know, there's the difference between cradling and, you know, I mean, how would he give himself a hand job?
I think that's this great tragedy. That's why he never asked for this.
I would so have he's asked breaking for those whiskey glasses. Oh dear. Poor Adam Jensen.
Maybe he could get an attachment for it.
That's why he's so highly strung.
I mean, he's understandably pissed off because he was shot in the head. That's how he's injured. And
but
wakes up with both his arms and legs replaced.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, you know those crash test dummy dolls you had as a kid? they knock him in the head and his arms and legs fall off.
That's the part of the cutscene you didn't see. Like, from your perspective, you just collapse. But later we see it from the terrorist perspective. You see him in the head and his arms and legs just pop off. Oh, we're going to need orcs for that, mate.
dear, this is a silly place. I used to play that game, but Dishonored is so close and looks so good.
Yeah. What have you been playing?
I have been playing Thumper, which is out next week, I think. Got an early copy. You might have heard of it already because it's been around, it's been around for a while. It's a rhythm action game that I think is by some former Harmonix people.
Right.
I think.
I've heard it described as a rhythm hell game.
Rhythm hell.
Rhythm violence, I think is what they went with in the description.
In and of itself, it is a, you know, a rhythm based Simon Says game. Like any, like Audio Surf or Guitar Hero or Rez or any of the games in that genre. And I think, so initially that makes it quite hard to describe because it's tremendously, like, it's a sensory experience that you dip into. And the game itself is sort of notable for having very little by way of like any kind of language or exposition. It's apart from a few like prompts that will say like up, down, whatever, when it's teaching you stuff. It basically has almost no words in it, and it's completely just about kind of your own interpretation of what you're doing and so on. So in this particular variant on it, you are like a shiny chrome beetle with a real sense of weight that is accelerating faster and faster and faster up a narrow sort of metal rail that has like sort of Tron stripes around it that is sort of curving and arcing through a kind of colorful metallic nebula full of these sort of twisting geometric shapes and sometimes these organic growths that spread and kind of like ripple and echo around the track. It looks, there's quite a lot of, I don't know, Ladytron album cover by way of, I don't know, the video that would play in the backdrop of a knife show or something like that. Like it's definitely rooted in that sort of side of electronica and in, but also in this sort of, because actually, unlike, you know, a lot of games have done that sort of style, but unlike even something like Dyad, I think, which is similar, it's not the sort of traditional video game kind of like lights and, you know, or electronic music and chiptune or something like that and everything being made of sort of like, energy. Everything is metal or like, and it feels sort of heavy and metallic, even though you're going hugely fast. There's a sort of strong sort of like tactile sense to everything. From your little beetle itself to the music and the sound effects. And while there are, you know, there are strings and there's some sort of orchestral stuff and there's some sort of more traditional electronic stuff, your contribution are these sort of like metallic sort of scrapes and bangs. Like you're banging bin lids together. Like as you kind of like go through this sort of like heavy sort of driving, like, yeah, like hell march kind of, rhythm thing. And your actions are, it's mega simple. Essentially you have, a button, space bar by default, which is thump, basically. It just thumps you onto the thing. You thump. The beetle sort of like slams down onto the track and glows. And then you modify that with the arrow keys. So slamming into either side of the track, slamming into the ground below you or jumping. And it teaches you just by trial and error. It does a nice thing of not ever really having to like ever stop to teach you something. Every time it introduces a new mechanic. So the very basic thing is a lit pad comes towards you on the track. And as you go over it, you tap the space bar, you thump it. And it teaches you that by just showing you it. And then you go over it. And if you do it right, it opens the door. And if it doesn't, you just keep going because the door is also like also ahead of you. Like the door is like keeping pace with you ahead of you and the door won't open until you do it right. So you never have to stop or like replay a section until you understand the new mechanic, but also never really has to say anything. It's just, and eventually these sort of ramp up in complexity. So you have these like side barriers to the track that you slam into by going into the you turn away from them and slam or thump. You have stuff that you jump over. You have, stuff that you plow through by holding down the button. And you have pads that you activate by slamming down after you're already up in the air, but you can only get up in the air after jumping off certain things. And so it's a really simple vocabulary. And like any of these games, you learn the vocabulary and then you, get faster and faster at reacting to it as it all sort of like comes streaming in towards you. And the structure is in a given level, which is fixed. They're not randomly generated. And they last a surprisingly long time. Like a level might have like 25 stages to it and each stage might take 30 seconds to a minute. So you're looking at like, and you kind of want to do them in a run. So like a run is not, it's not like a super hexagon star game or something where you kind of like go, 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 die, start again. Your run actually lasts a while. You're in there for like 25 minutes going faster and faster and faster and faster. And for the most part, it's just about getting through the levels and getting onto the next stage. And it's all sort of contiguous and you get a score at the end of each sort of section. And obviously you can S rank stuff and there's all that side of it. And as you go, you can die and be reset back to the start of it. And that's handled by if you fuck up once, your beetle's wings get blown off. And if you fuck up again, you die. But if you get to the end of the section, there's a kind of cool animation of the wings kind of clicking back into place and you zoom off again. It's all, you know, everything's beautifully animated. And then twice per level, you, in the middle and at the end, you have a boss battle. And the boss battles are essentially like, challenges where you do damage by like, building up a certain amount of combo by getting things right. And then thumping a pad that will then glow extra bright. And this causes this brilliant effect where, sort of everything slows down and warps around the point of your beetle, which then fires this bolt of energy that arcs around the track in front, down the track in front of you and hits the boss. And the last boss of every stage, he shows up again and again, is a big angry head called Crackhead. that floats around in front of you going, ah, and then you pound him with the metal magic sound bullets. And, it's fucking great. It's one of the things, because it's so sensory, it's hard to describe necessarily, because you're trying to, you know, express this feeling of this particular sense of sort of motion and sound and your participation in that. And it's very good at bringing about that sort of trance state that other games like this, other games that are a lot like this, like Rez or Super Hexagon do. But also the sort of the level of concentration that goes with any kind of like really fast reaction based score attack game like Devil Daggers or something like that. Like it has a lot of those same rhythms. So the moments where you're doing really well at something and then you start to repeatedly fuck up something, you know, you can do because your brain just isn't in that particular gear it needs to be in. It has that very, very pared down. You know, the best thing about these games is they like reduce you basically to just this reaction. And if you start thinking, like if you get distracted by like, oh, what am I going to do later? Then suddenly you start being bad at the game. So that's great.
Can you learn it? As in, is it the same patterns of actions each time, like something like Guitar Hero?
Yes.
Or is it? Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's not random.
So you can, like, maybe just learn.
I think
it
so.
By
so
heart?
I have, like, so I think so. There's something that I'm actually not sure about. Because essentially, for a while, I thought each track ended at a certain point. But actually, I'm not sure if track sections actually end when you reach a certain combo. I don't think that's true because I feel like I scrubbed my way through some of them. But the thing is, the whole levels are so long that you're very unlikely to memorize the entire thing. I mean, obviously, there are people who've memorized like 20-minute songs and stuff. But you know sections, and again, it's almost impossible to describe. But like, at this level of like, you know, really quick reaction to stuff. Different types of section have their own character. So if something's got a lot of like tapping in it and then some sliding, then it feels different to something that's mostly sliding with some holding. And it sounds like barely an interaction, but it is. That's the entire game. And so you can memorize what that kind of demand is going to be. Like this one's very kind of like staccato. And if you want to do it right, then you need to go up and down and so on. It builds complexity in that way. But the best thing about these games is that memorization is sort of something that you almost can't articulate. It just sort of sinks in. I don't think you could ever like write it down or even describe it in a podcast. It's an issue. Something it made me think about, this maybe is a bit of a half-formed thought, but honestly, I don't have much to say about it other than it's amazing. Like it's the kind of game that people will wax lyrical about and otherwise struggle to articulate its flaws or successes and then probably give it perfect scores because it is in that category of brilliant rhythm action game that comes along every now and then. But something made me think about is, and it relates to what we were saying earlier about Twitch friendly games, is this is like it's very watchable. And you're watching someone who's good at it. Like one of the trailers they released was just 30 seconds of contiguous play of the game because you don't need to say anything else about it. You just, this is what it is and this is how it sounds, this is how it looks. But it's not about the person playing. It's about the mastery that you impart the power that imparts over you. You play by its rules or you fail. And that's what's fun about it is sort of submitting yourself to this sort of like, you know, exciting, punishing challenge. And as such, it actually stands in quite stark contrast with specifically Cluster Truck, which came out recently, which is a puzzle game, well, a puzzle platformer, not puzzle game, platform game, where you jump from truck to truck as they kind of race down a big valley. It's very sort of physics-based and slapstick. And a trial-and-error timing score attack Twitch game, but it's explicitly designed to be sort of sloppy around the edges and look really silly. And the developers have done some interesting things to actively court Twitch, so they have the ability to sort of jump into people's games in progress. And so they've done that to streamers, like hack their games and change the color of things and stuff like that live, which essentially it's a publicity thing. There's nothing wrong with that. But obviously like that kind of like, I guess that sort of characterful broadcast friendliness comes from the slapstick element to those games, the dynamic physics, the capacity for accidents. You can kind of whoop at the crazy things that have happened in those games. And the games aren't ruined if you have superimposed your own face in a green screen in the bottom corner while you interact with your subs, or overlaid it with your own Twitch overlay. Whereas this is nice in the sense it's a lot more rooted in that old console solipsistic rhythm action heritage, where it's not like, I could think of nothing worse than someone talking over that game. It's a total sort of like, you know, I'm not going to be a person now. I'm going to be a fucking metal beetle searing up one of fucking Disco Cthulhu's metal nerves. And that's, you know, that's the appeal of it. And I find that an interesting, again, it's not necessarily fully formed thought, but it's an interesting contrast between games that are ostensibly similar is, perhaps as developers see the value of courting a spectator audience, they might move away from those games that are purely about this sort of wordless interaction of synapse and game.
I'm sure it won't stop streamers, you know, putting their face on it and talking over it. And I wonder if it'll make it not come across well. Like, obviously they will be losing, the viewers will be losing something that they would be getting if they played it properly. But maybe it'll be obvious that that's the case. And if that happens, it's almost kind of a good thing if the viewers of a stream can tell they'll be having a better experience if they're playing it themselves, because you want them to go out and buy it, right?
yeah, hopefully.
I think it sounds like the sort of thing that would be impossible to talk and play well, you know? Like, I can't imagine that if you were talking, you'd be able to do the combinations and button presses and just the awareness of the rhythm that you would actually need, because your voice then interrupts that and imparts a cadence of its own. So I think that would probably stop that. But like, also it sort of surprises me that that hasn't been a bigger part of Twitch that I've seen, because some of my earliest recollections of videos that me and friends would watch at university, you know, just on, you know, not YouTube, probably like Ebaum's World or something like that, was, you know, like people doing really well at DDR or something, you know, like, so, like some guy who was playing on two mats at the same time, you know, machines right next to each other and just sort of keeping both of them going. Like, that stuff was amazing, and that sort of seems to tap into this same thing. And also just watching people do amazingly at the really difficult songs on Rock Band or Guitar Hero and things like that in person, you know, just sort of seeing the crazy finger movements that I couldn't even do because my fingers are too small and my little finger can't reach the orange button. So I couldn't play the normal difficulty.
You're right that it certainly has that appeal. Like, I would definitely watch someone ace it at the highest level, I think. So yeah, as I say, not necessarily a full criticism, because I think there's plenty of space for broadcasting a game like that. But the thing I think that's probably closest to superficially that's recent is almost its polar opposite philosophically, which is it interesting? I don't know. Maybe.
I think because I wasn't actually disagreeing with you. It was more that actually I think that maybe the concern that somebody chatting over it might ruin it might not hold up, simply because I don't know that people will be able to chat over it and ruin it.
Indeed.
Their faces might still be hovering around, but
someone,
you know,
came over to ask me if I was enjoying it while I was playing it today, and I immediately enjoyed it a lot less.
Well, not now.
Oh man, I hope I can get it to work. hope my PC finally behaves.
Is it out?
13th?
It's out on the 13th. Reviews will be up by the time this comes out, this podcast.
Shall we do questions from questions?
Yes. Here Good. They are. Here they come now, look. Holding hands. Zed Fang writes, IF Comp 2016 is currently happening. How do the panel get on with interactive fiction?
I dabble with it rarely, but I have found things I like. The one we've talked about most, I guess the one I like the most, and hence I've talked about here the most, was called... a name I can't remember. It was where you play like a hardball detective who is an alcoholic and you're investigating a murder and you're going around the house talking to the witnesses and stuff, and it's there's just a lot of options to examine and talk to people and present evidence to people and things like that.
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean.
I'm totally forgetting what it's called. I saw it again recently because I was going through my bookmarks and I think it saves your progress in the URL, so you can just bookmark the page to kind of save where you were. And so I can go back to it at any time. But I heard that something like 2/3 or 3/4 of the entries to the IF Comp this year are in Twine, which is interesting because, presumably these are not, text input type things. They're multiple choice stuff, which is, I think, a lot more appealing to me. Because like IF, usually if you're having to write in your verbs and stuff, there's kind of an accepted set of things you can expect to work and a set of things you expect not to work. And I'm not conversant in that, so I always stumble with it. Like any IF game, that everyone says, oh, you got to play this one, and I'll play it, and I'm like, none of my commands worked, and I can't figure out how to leave this room. And so I much prefer it if it just tells me what my options are. Like, here are the 10 things you can do here.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I feel the same way. I think. I haven't played as much as I should, really, even how much I enjoy things like Fallen London that are some part of that family tree.
Mm.
What's the, Tom, you might know this, what's the game that Tony Ellis is always recommending? IF game, the spider and the thing?
I was going to say one of the Lovecraft ones. There was like an IF game that was always in the top 100.
Yeah,
was,
that's what I mean.
Was it the something about Innsmouth?
That's Call of Cthulhu, Shadows Over Innsmouth, I think. No, that's the name of the short story. I've got completely turned around. I'm sure I'll put it in the show notes. There's one that Tony Ellis has recommended every year that I've worked at PC Gamer. Yeah. But I've still never played it. But you might be right as well.
Does Emily Short do like an IF roundup for IPS?
Yeah, it's called If Only.
Yes, very good.
Yeah, so that's cool. I think Brendy sometimes includes them in his freeloaders column as well. And I've been meaning to get more into seeing what's out there actually off the back of those, although recently I picked one up on just on a whim because the name sounded it's called The Lords of the Earth Flame, I think. I was just like, what's that?
So different to the Wizards of Earth.
Well, indeed, and I think I'd also been playing something else that had like that similar like Flame Lord kind of thing going on, so I thought
Rogue of Earth Air.
Why not? So I picked that up and it had this gloriously ridiculous sex scene in like a mountain cave system that you get trapped in with your caravan of fellow travelers. And it's like, I'd clearly been taken with it to the point where I wrote the lines out in a Google Doc for later, kind of trying to figure out what to do with them. I put it in an article today, but it was, you know, like, so my character ended up sort of seducing this lady who'd hurt her foot as part of the thing that got us trapped in the mountain cave thing. And, but it was like, it kind of took a lot of rom-com tropes, like, you know, sort of the bit where, I don't know, the cute girl or the cute boy gets something on their face and the other one wipes it off and then there's a moment kind of thing. That happened between me and this injured girl called Gerda, simply when I fed her a bit of my mate's horse that I'd butchered because we were all going to die. Oh no, that I'd got my other friend to butcher because we were all going to die. And she had like blood on her lips. So I like, I think my character just like leans over and like delicately wipes it away. And he, you know, like the description of her is quite entertaining because it's like, her hair was like satin and her lips like foreign fruits. You know, it's kind of all of these things.
And her face like horse blood.
I think Graham was like, you mean like a pineapple? And I was just like, oh, I don't know. And then like, I'm sort of checking in on her injured foot later, but then my hands end up sort of lifting the hem of her dress and there's a kind of narrative equivalent of fade to black kind of, ooh. And then you wake up the next morning on like a cowhide rug and you accidentally fling one of the horse bones at the ceiling. And like, and I'll then you say. Find a ruby and like my version of it was you just sort of descended into this weird hell dimension, which I mean, sure, fine, why not? Like, but otherwise it was just this kind of like rather overwritten, but I think the game started out in Russian or the developer is Russian. So, you know, like I don't want to be rude in that I think it might be an English as a second language thing, but also they are selling it for like £4. And I mean, it's half price at the moment, so maybe worth a punt, but like it was sort of entertaining in that way of like, this is bizarre, but also just quite fun and ridiculous. So I kind of enjoyed that, but like, it also had that thing where I was reading through the Steam description and stuff, and it kind of billed it as like, oh, I want to, you know, sort of bring this. I really can't remember the phrasing. I wish I could, but it was to the essentially about bringing this sort of neglected genre back to life. And you're kind of like, no, it's not neglected. You're just not looking at the other work that people are doing, perhaps. I don't know. But yeah, so it was one of those peculiar experiences that I, like, I don't want to poke fun at it, but it was just funny to play through and sort of have this, yeah, sex scene, rom-com style play out amongst sort of the debris of a horse carcass, I guess. So, yeah.
Patrick writes, Dear Dr. Crate, the hot take and the terribly cursed crowbar, how would you design a John Le Carré game?
I realized when thinking about this, so John Le Carré wrote Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and a bunch of other things, Tailor of Panama and The Constant Gardener, and a book that I don't really see referenced much, but which was the first one I read by him, was called Call for the Dead. And I realized I have come up with a game design that's basically inspired by that book, which is, there's a chapter in the book. I feel like I might mention this podcast before. Apologies if this is all familiar, but a chapter in the book where the main character, who is investigating a suicide that he doesn't think is really a suicide, he's looking at like a porcelain statue on his mantelpiece that is in some way tied to a character who has told him a lot of information. And while looking at it and kind of reflecting on it, he realizes that if you take everything this woman has said out, if you assume everything she's ever said is a lie, then the whole thing can be flipped on its head. And the whole chapter is just him reorganizing all of his thoughts about the case and realizing that, like, he's made so many assumptions based on what she said and things that she, you know, would have no reason to lie about. And, she's not under suspicion directly. And, he suddenly realizes that, oh, if you just assume she was lying about everything, then there's a whole other way to make sense of this and it all clicks together much better. And I really wanted to make a game about that. And so I would love to have a detective game where everything you've been told, everyone who tells you what happened that night on the night of the incident, you get to see that like played out, kind of like The Vanishing of Ethan Carter, where you see like memories and you get to kind of rewind and scrub through them. But let's say it's like a Midsummer Murders type setting, and it's a little village, and you get to see the people walking around. And when someone's telling you, "Oh, I saw the vicar leaving the chapel at 6 p.m., then you get to see the vicar leaving the chapel at 6 p.m. But that's all like colored blue, because the person whose color is blue is telling you that. And then later on, when someone else tells you, "Actually, I saw the vicar in the shop at 6:15, then that's color green, and it'll like show everyone's version of events kind of simultaneously, and you can layer them on top of each other. And then you can see where they conflict and where they might be, you know, out by a little and where they might be out by a lot, and try and make sense of what happened and see where people agree and where they don't. And then sort of toggle people on and off and see like, okay, this doesn't make sense. Clearly it's a big mess. Everyone's saying someone's in a different position. Who can we take out of this where it will make sense? Like, if you just remove the red version of events and the purple version of events, does everything else agree with each other? Like, roughly. And like, I think like games could be a brilliant interface for sorting through that stuff. And the reason I haven't made it is that I think it might be a really good tool for sorting through people's testimony and not so much a great game idea. Cause like either that works or it doesn't. And if it works, then it makes it trivially easy. And you know, the police should be informed immediately. and if it doesn't work, then it would just be annoying.
That's a good idea though. Really cool. I don't have an idea for this. Really. I don't know if there's a good way of having a series of really tense meetings in a game necessarily.
Is the Constant Gardener the one about possibly some terrible things happening?
I need to narrow it down.
So,
it does
okay.
include conflict, I believe, yeah.
So it's... There's a certain amount of colonialism, maybe, or like something terrible happening abroad with Rachel Weisz in the film. That
I'm
is
pretty
the
sure
only
the
thing
movie
I've
is
seen.
Rachel Weisz and Ralph Fiennes.
Yeah, I think I cried a lot, and I don't remember why. But, I mean, like, I remember being very upset and Rachel Weisz being there. So
either is that film or Rachel Weisz came over and
I think I thought it might be slightly more sort of Merchant Ivory stuff about gardening, and then it really wasn't. Thought maybe it was like a romance involving a gardener, and then, yeah, it wasn't.
No, Gerald, you and your constant gardening.
Well, no, I've given like, it up for you, Margaret. His heart was constant. You know? Like, he was a constant man.
Oh, I see.
Right, you know? Or she was a constant lady. I don't, you know, it's...
He was a constant man. She was a constant lady.
They just wouldn't
they
quit.
They had a garden.
Did I tell you about the time that I thought I was going to watch a Will Smith film and it turned out to be a film about the Second World War and the Nazis, and it was in a foreign language? and it wasn't involving Will
Did he
Smith
not even
at
rap
all.
At the start?
No, this is a story. All about World War One.
Yeah. It was about like this woman who was in the resistance, and it was called The Black Book, I think. And I thought it was going to be a jolly romp involving Will Smith, and then it was sort of about the Holocaust and like people avoiding the Holocaust. So that was a thing that happened. I'm not very good with films, I don't think. what was I talking about?
John le Carré.
Oh, I don't really have any ideas because that's the only thing I know about him. But I thought maybe they could do a collaboration with American musicians and then it could be a cash and carry.
Oh, no. I mean, I think one of the things I find compelling about his spy fiction and spy fiction generally is like, the really horrible life of being undercover and the danger people are in, people, you know, in the former Soviet Union and so on. Maybe there's a game in like a version of The Sims where you're moving your family into a neighborhood, but your family are either Russian spies in the US or, you know, maybe British spies in somewhere in Eastern Europe or something, and you've got to blend in through a series of social engagements.
It's like Octodad, but
yeah. Like Octodad meets Papers, Please meets The Sims meets John le Carré novel. I don't know exactly what the mechanics of that would be, other than like, you know, don't fuck it up and get shot in the back of the head in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
But, you know. Anywho. George Prosser writes, that Nidhogg 2 art style, though, ? So, yeah, news we missed is Nidhogg 2 was revealed last week with a very new, very different art style to the original game. Was a sort of 8-bit, very, very pared down, not even really 8-bit, sort of Atari pixel thing.
Yeah.
And the new one is much more derived from, like, 16-bit era kind of claymation-y,
yeah,
gross-out sort of the cartoon platformers, I guess.
The guy who does it does do actual work in clay. I don't know if this is based on it or what.
But certainly looks like.
Yeah.
Also a lot of screaming. Basically, you play like two naked Homer Simpsons. That
it looks very much like naked Homer Simpson.
Scream at each other constantly as they disembowel each other with knives and bows and stuff. When the trailer came in early in the office before the embargo for its release, and I think everyone hated it except me. I really like it. How you feel, Tom?
I kind of hate it, I'm afraid. I don't mind. It's pretty grotesque, and I don't think I mind that. But I think what I don't like about it is that it looks funny, and the game is funny. But when the game looks funny, it's like it's kind of trying to be in on the joke. Mm. And I don't know, there's something about that that I don't find as funny. Like, it was a very conscious decision for Gunpoint to make the art look really serious, even though the game is going to have slapstick humor in it and people falling on their face and getting hit in the face with a door and lots of, like, silly noises. And I think just my sense of humor is much more like, if things look serious, I can find them funnier than if they look wacky.
See, I think I probably maybe agree with that a bit, actually. I like the animation and the art and that era of art and the things it's recalling. But yeah, you're right that maybe it isn't necessary for a game that is sort of just hilarious and violent and silly and achieves those things by inference, as it was.
A strange thing about Nidhogg 1 was the two main characters were like yellow and orange, which is odd colours to pick in the first place, but also they were just completely flat colour. Like, there was some detail to the backgrounds, I think, but the players themselves were flat colour, and then their blood was the same colour as their skin, I guess. And so it was this weird thing where, like, when someone's bleeding profusely, there's a special move where you could, like, move your sword up and down and someone and blood is just spurting out all the time. But it was the same color as them, and then it was just lying on the floor and would stain the floor. And I don't know if that was, like, I don't know why they chose not to have... I suppose they wanted it to be clear who the blood came from, so you could see, like, oh, the yellow person died a lot here or something. But that was an interesting stylistic choice.
I think clay is kind of grotesque anyway, as an art form.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know, not as bad as my sister. My sister hates Wallace and Gromit. Like, she can't watch it. She thinks it's disgusting. But I think there is, like, clay artwork tends towards the grotesque. So anything that reminds me of that feels automatically a bit repellent.
Mm. I'm okay with repellent, actually, in the context of Nidhogg.
I quite liked it playing it straight, though, because I've only played Nidhogg a few times. And, like, you know, a little tournament at a friend's house. But it was, yeah, like what Tom was saying, it the humour and the joy of it came as it was thrown even more into focus by the fact that the backdrop and the artwork and stuff were all so pared down and so minimalist and you were projecting a lot onto them, and the movement itself was funny, as in, you know, you'd stumble and you'd basically drop your rapier, and that was, you know, like, you could be like, oh God, you know, you've fumbled and you feel sort of quite frantic and things, because it's so pared down, you can really see those actions and they provide a real sort of neutral space onto which you can project more.
Yeah, I mean, greater fidelity of animation has its own benefits when it comes to that stuff, so hopefully it'll patch up in that way.
Yeah. I also think that once I start playing it, I will forget completely about any reservations I have. Like, I think it probably doesn't really matter what it looks like.
No, well, if anything, the first game did prove that. Sorry. Pigeon writes, Dear Container and Crossbow, first of all, congratulations to Pip and Chris on their Esports Journalist of the Year nominations.
Oh, yeah.
That happened.
Cheers.
Incidentally, it's probably a good time to mention that Crate and Crowbar is nominated for for a Games Media Award next week. We were nominated last year as well.
Oh.
Probably even the year before that. I don't know. We've never won it, but it's happened again.
That's nice.
So that's nice.
Mm. I'm sad to miss, actually. I'm going to be at Dev Days, but I enjoyed it last year.
Periscope in.
And enjoyed losing.
Well, I'll be there to lose on our behalf. Sorry. His question. As a question, given that the League of Legends World Championship is just about upon us, what
it's
feature...
on us.
Indeed. I think this world's question was written...
It's clambered atop.
We moved this question forward from last week, who was sans Pip last week. Ooh. So it's... He was right when he wrote it. What feature or aspect of the international, as in the Dota 2 international, experience would you most like to see appear in Riot's production, not including changing the game to Dota 2? Thanks for the great pods, Pigeon.
I think I was talking to you about this before, Chris, because I think that Riot tend to put on really high production value events. Obviously, it's like one of their things. And so, like, the effort that goes into making sure that the casters and people can always keep, like, stuff going and make things entertaining and stuff is one of the things that they really excel at. I think something that I miss from, or I expect to miss from the international as Worlds plays out this month is so at TI, firstly, the meta was so ridiculously broad in terms of the scope of pro play that it allowed and the number of heroes that you could place within that. So I think it was 105 out of 110 playable heroes in competitive mode. And I would love to see League approaching that, level of flexibility in terms of the picks and things. Like, I haven't watched all of groups so far. I think I've only managed to watch like a day's worth of matches because there's so many of them and it's on completely the wrong time zone for me. But, you know, from what I'd seen, it's still very much that, you know, there are particular picks and bands that you gravitate towards. And, you know, it's not that it precludes interesting games. It's just that I loved how flexible and how much variety there was in the Dota meta, particularly this year. And the other thing is I do miss that sense of, I don't want to say global competitiveness, because there have been a couple of upsets already in the group stages, international wildcard teams, you know, triumphing against people with world-class talent on their teams, you know, and with far more scope for practicing against other top-tier players. So it's not that the regions aren't viable exactly, but it's that they do tend to get narrativized. Like the Korean region is the one to beat, and LMS, which is oh God.
Taiwan.
Well, I mean, it's Taiwan and a couple of other places like Macau, I think. Mm. And, I should know this. It's just not on the tip of my tongue. But so they're always billed as like the dark horse of the competition. And you're like, there's only so many times you can call them a dark horse before you realize they're just a horse.
Very, you know? Well illuminated.
Like, they're just.
We have seen the horse. The horse is right there.
Yeah. And so you're kind of like, and you know, you sort of get to the point where like people are sort of still acting surprised that, I don't know, like Flash Wolves are doing as well as they're doing in any given competition. And you're kind of like, well, you know, it's, and you know, so Whereas in Dota, you get like these organizations that have players from all over the world and that can kind of come from a wider variety of places, just sort of showing up and then remixing in volatile sort of team. Although it hasn't been too bad this year, actually. I feel like I'm giving a really, really boring answer.
Those are the two things I would say.
But yeah, and so there is scope for it to be a bit different, and it feels like the wildcard regions are more able to hold their own this year, but it's very much a kind of, you know, you've got your five main league systems and they pick from sort of those regions with a little bit of overlap, but with, you know, rules in place that stop too many players from outside a particular region from dominating that team. And so, yeah, it's just a bit like it's nice to see Dota being quite so eclectic in some ways.
It's notable how different the two games are competitively.
Mm.
One of them has regional dominance, the other one doesn't.
Mm.
One of them has a competitive meta that's very distinct. The other one doesn't. Given how similar they are in some ways. Well, I would say they're not similar at all. But
well, yeah. I mean, you know, I would... I don't really know. Because, like, with League, the way that they've set it up, I mean, there's lots that you could say that to criticize the way that they run the professional leagues and stuff, and some of that has been well discussed recently in terms of, you know, business practices and viability and things like that. But from a viewer perspective, there is a kind of soap opera-ness to it that makes it a bit easier to tap into an event like Worlds when it comes around if you have been following, you know, your particular region's league championship series or something. You know, like as somebody who watches, I don't know, some North American LCS, some Korea, some EU LCS, like I have some of those narratives already in place by the time Worlds comes around. And so I have teams that I'm particularly interested in. I have like Rox Tigers, who I've been fond of since, you know, they were GE Tigers, you know, it's stuff like that. Or like, you know, you get to know players in that sort of, or team identities in that week by week basis.
Mm.
Whereas with something like Dota, if you miss out on particular tournaments or if somebody was at something and then not at something else, it can be harder to unpick those structures. So
Craig writes, "Dear Crate and Crowbar, in a recent podcast, you suggested that Bad Company 2 is the best Battlefield game. I think I suggested that. This leaves me with a number of questions, such as, why didn't you ever try out Battlefield 2142? And when did you start being so wrong about everything? Incidentally, a fan-developed revival of 2142 was released this week with no comment yet from EA's legal department. But eventually, all online games and services must die. Which do you fear that most fear the loss of?" I confess, I'm not actually sure what he's referring to out of which in that sentence, but...
Yeah, I guess online services dying. I mean, Steam would be bad.
Yeah.
I wanted to chime in and say, I think Graham also agrees with you that Bad Company 2 is the best.
Yeah, I think Top Senior does as well.
Yeah, probably. But my favorite was Battlefield 2, just regular Battlefield 2.
It's a strong choice as well.
I think probably largely because it was just like, a bunch of my friends were playing at that time, and by the time Bad Company 2 came out, I don't know, maybe it just didn't click with me, or for whatever reason, I didn't play a lot of it. And Battlefield 2 was like, I think it was technologically astonishing at the time, like the size of those maps and like the visual fidelity was incredible. And it just felt like such a like breath of fresh air. It was just like being in that place was amazing. And then the like sound design is incredible. And yeah, I spent many happy hours in that game. And the like commander and squad system was also really good. And 2142, so I don't know how much this stuff carried over to the later games because I didn't get into them as much, but 2142 had really good squad system where you would, if you're the squad leader, when you give an order to your squad, like, hey, let's take this capture point C. If they do it, they get a bunch of, like, extra points for having done it. Like, you get, you know, 2 points for capturing this point, but you also get 2 more points because you were told to capture this point, and you're actually doing what you're told to do. And then you as squad leader also get a bunch of extra bonus points because your squad did what you told them to do. And so, like, working as a unit was really highly incentivized, and that was, like, your actual score on the scoreboard, you know, it was mixed in with your frags and whatever else. So I remember that being, like, really, really cool. 2142 also had, like, some really cool game modes, like the Titans, where every control point you were capturing was actually a missile launcher that was shooting the enemy Titan. And once it got low enough, you could launch yourself up there and then land on it and run inside. The Titans were, like, hovering motherships. And you could land on it and then, like, break into it and run through its corridors and sabotage these certain stations, take down its shields, and then overload its core. And then when it was going to blow up and you'd already won the match, you would still have to run out of the Titan and then jump off it. And the enemies would still be there, and they'd be trying to, like, mow you down as you got out. And it was awesome to, like, parachute off one of those things while the match ends and you had won. So I kind of see the guy's point.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a great game. I know, arguing that. The reason I would always say Bad Company 2 is because it succeeded a lot of the small things. Maybe Battlefield was traditionally, for a couple of years, or its first couple of years, it was always about escalation and how much bigger it could get and how much more kind of ambitious it could be technically, which maybe culminates in 2142 and all those things that you mentioned. The reason I like Bad Company 2 so much is it felt like the game where they dialed it back and focused on getting small things right, like the persistence of destructible buildings across that game and that becoming more of a reliable feature, and the guns being great, and a quite a tight balance of classes and upgrades and stuff. And also just a more focused map design. It's we talked about this when we were discussing the Battlefield 1 beta, but the irony of Battlefield is it's sort of showcase feature are these massive maps with a million things going on and 64 players fighting on loads of different fronts at once. But its best mode is the really straightforward attack defense mode where everyone's on the same page and everyone's moving in a straight line and the teams are smaller. And it's great that the game can support both, but for me, Bad Company, that is the best of Battlefield, and Bad Company 2 is the best of that. And that's why it is the best one. Even though it doesn't have the airplanes, which I like. But I appreciate the other options are also available. Robin writes, hello, listening to a 10-year-old episode of the PC Gamer podcast, Jesus, where this was discussed, I came to wondering, whatever happened to in-game advertising? Was it replaced by microtransactions? Goodbye.
I remember this was a big scare with Human Revolution, actually. That wasn't 10 years ago, though, was it? Was it? Can't have been.
No, that was 2011.
Yeah.
So 5 years ago.
Yeah, because it was the same year as Skyrim. I don't remember what was a big deal 10 years ago about in-game advertising, but everyone was scared Human Revolution would be ruined by big Coke ads, and I don't think it was. I don't think it really became a thing at all. Like, no one kicked up a fuss about it. The way it was done was, like, the billboards in the game that would be adverts anyway were adverts for real products.
But that's more kind of on the lines of product placement, isn't it?
Yeah, and there's certainly lots of that, like, in the Splinter Cell games, for example. There's, like, the bit in Chaos Theory that I'm sure we talked about where, like, the, all of New York is hit by an EMP bomb except for a giant, like, Wrigley's sign.
God.
It's a diesel-powered Wrigley's sign.
I'd say that in-game advertising is still alive and well in mobile games, like, especially, like, you know, particularly the free versions of things.
Yeah, so those, like, literally have a banner ad on the screen that you kind of have to...
Or in, there's a few sort of clicker games, like I was playing a game called Abyssarium, I think, or Abyssrium, which, yes. Anyway, so it was basically you had a deep undersea coral and fish garden thing that you were just cultivating, and some of that was by clicking on it, and some of it was just, you know, over time you'd get a certain amount of auto clicks and you'd earn currency and buy fish and buy, you know, coral upgrades and stuff like that. But one of the things that you could do to speed up the process or to automatically reset some of your abilities that would help you gain in-game currency to spend on those fish and corals and things was you would agree to watch like a 30-second advert or something. And so, you know, it was a kind of you were paying, but you were paying with your attention on a product. And actually it was interesting because a lot of it was you would spend a lot of time looking at adverts for other free-to-play games. So it was kind of weird because maybe if you were advertised to enough, you'd just move in a big circle around all of these free to play games and, you know, who makes the money there, I guess, but, they're just making money from each other at that point. But, yeah, so that's where I encounter it now.
Like the term in game advertising was about like somewhere between product placement and that, which is things like billboards where, or I guess like sometimes there were slots on like the menus as well, but things where it would be pulling in a sort of live ad. So like the Wrigley's product placement in Chaos Theory was obviously hard coded and that was just part of like a deal that was a lot more like movie product placement. And then like, things like ads on a website is, usually there'll be like a slot and then some kind of system actually decides what the ad is fed into that. And then like the thing with Human Revolution was that the billboards in the game would be kind of hooked up to some online service where they could like load ads in depending on what ad deal they had running that week. And my guess is that that turned out not to actually be profitable. Like the fact that we don't see it anymore, or it doesn't, certainly if it's happening, it's so unobtrusive that we literally can't tell it's happening, suggests that there's not a lot of money to be made doing it.
I wonder if partly it's because of how you record the data on that. So, I mean, you know, obviously you'd have maybe some way of tracking it. For example, if there was a particular code attached to an advert that people could use to activate a particular offer or something, then that might be a way of tracking it. But otherwise, you know, with websites and things, you've got click-through rates and you've got, you know, other types of methods to see if people are paying attention or even just page views. You know, it's a very broad kind of, you know, and it ignores ad blockers and things. But, you know, you have a rough sense of how many eyeballs may have seen that stuff. But if it's being projected onto a building in a game that you may or may not even be looking at or that might be playing, but your character is facing completely the wrong direction, you know, like, how much of that ambient sort of just being present in a game is even worth recording as attention anyone will pay.
I guess like they can track it better than a real life billboard because they actually could have metrics in there that measure how long did you spend looking at it. But yeah, I still don't know how much it's really worth.
And given the cost of implementation as well, like relative to the number of people who are likely to see it.
And imagine the backlash of this thing needs to be always online for ads.
Like that actually happened, like with well, I suppose APB had to be always online anyway. But
you know what I mean. Like I can't imagine that any audience would particularly take kindly to that.
No, indeed. It's also, I mean, you know, from the day to day life of working in media, you kind of know that, you know, what advertisers want to get out of, you know, display ads on a website, which are guaranteed to maybe have a couple of million people pass them in a month. And also if the website loads and the button isn't running an ad blocker, the advert is there on the 2D plane that they are looking at. Whereas the idea of maybe having an advert float around potentially to be seen by people out of maybe the 100,000, 200,000 people who buy a game.
But that's what I was saying. Like you might not even be looking in the right direction. No, I know.
I don't know what I'm sure advertisers have a really specific term for this, but there's no like follow through action. Like you see the ad and then you can't, like click in a mobile ad, probably you're probably right that everyone went to mobile for this because on a mobile ad, they can just put it in front of the game and you literally can press it and then it'll take you to that game instead or whatever the other product they're selling.
Yeah. It takes you to the install page on the Google
play.
Yeah, the thing to highlight is simply not just the problems with the implementation, but the gulf between it and more traditional forms of implementation of display advertising. Like, it takes both of those things for it to be a failure. Like, if it was a cool novel idea that was actually, like, getting a benefit, even if it was a small amount of people, great. But it's, like, not very effective, unreliable, and not as many people will see it as would just see a website ad.
Yeah.
So, probably dead for those reasons. John writes, "Greetings, Harpocrates and Socars. I have recently, after gaming for about 30 years, come to understand a bit more about the types of games I enjoy. I enjoy the power that games can present, to be a force within a world that is godlike. As such, I more enjoy games like Diablo 3 and Grim Dawn, where my little man-woman voodoo priest thing kills countless giant things and gets stronger every time. It also explains in my youth, when time permitted, I didn't mind grinding in Final Fantasy, as it was purely me exerting my power over the cannon fodder to get better. I enjoy 4X-style games, but I put them on easy and often cheat to give myself increased resource so that the world will bow to my will. It also helps me understand why I didn't get on with MOBAs, but enjoyed things like Dawn of War 2 and Warcraft 3's hero missions. Finally, it also explains why I hate to die in games and will often quit rather than restart, as my precious fantasy of being the most powerful person has been overturned. I'm not going to linger on the psychology of this, or the negative behaviour around it, rage deleting Destiny after a night with Urox the Flame Prince and Arkburn. Instead, I'd like to ask you, what games to you are the ultimate power fantasy? Secondly, has Tom F. heard the Gunpoint podcast on Kane and Rince? And then thirdly, asked a question about Destiny, but should we get round to doing the Destiny podcast we'd like to do, perhaps we'll answer then.
I have indeed heard the Kane and Rince podcast about Gunpoint, and it's great. The Kane and Rince is like, they pick one game and go super in-depth on it, so that's really nice when it's your game.
Or horrible, I imagine.
Yeah, hypothetically. But luckily they liked it. The power fantasy thing, yeah. So, like, in raw terms, like, how much power you have in the game, I think maybe doesn't link up that closely to how powerful you feel. So, you know, the most powerful I've ever been in the game is probably Galaxy of Two, where I destroyed many, many suns. Like, I destroyed multiple solar systems, like, more than I actually kept count of. That felt pretty good. But in terms of, like, I know what he means. Like, there are some games where just, like, you're this person in this situation, except super, super powerful. And the one that sprang to mind was the Prototype games. Both are, I think, mechanically really fun and narratively terrible. And the second one is better, but it's, unfortunately, it was a terrible PC port, and I don't know if they've cleaned it up since. But both, basically, you are a person in New York City where you've been mutated to the point that you can, like, turn your arms usually into different things, like claws or long metal whips or giant boulders. And each of those modes has different, like, advantages and stuff. But also, you're just sort of, like, one of your basic abilities is walk up to anyone in the city and just eat them. And in the process of eating them, also become them. So you look like them for a while. And you can also run up to anyone, and if you're jumping at the time, then you can just, like, simultaneously kill them and then surf on their corpse, which will slide you along the street. And if you run into a building, you just run up the building. Like, you can just run vertically. And then once you jump off the building, you can also glide just with your arms. Like, you don't have wings or anything. You just put your arms out, and now you can glide. And it's one of those games that just, like, never says no to you. Whatever you do, it's just like, yes, you can do that. Okay, sure. And, like, even when you fight giant mutants and stuff, if you've got the blade arms, then, yeah, you can just rip through them and tear them apart from the inside. And if you run up a building, then you can also, like, go into boulder arms mode and then jump off the building and do, like, a dive bomb thing that does more damage the higher you do it from. So if you see a tank, like, a legitimate strategy is, oh, there's a tank there, it's going to take a lot of, like, damage, I should run up this skyscraper and jump from the very top of it with my boulder arms so that when I land in it, I've come from, like, literally 3 kilometers and destroy it in one hit.
The first prototype's on one of the handful of open world games I've 100%ed, weirdly. I played the sequel as well, but I didn't 100% the sequel. I don't know why I 100%ed the first one. It was a weird Xbox-based time in my life. I agree. Those have a very specific sense of you being enormously powerful and that becoming the game rather than necessarily it being breaking the game.
which it could.
Yeah.
They're not great games, but they're good at that.
It's completely, like, amoral. It just doesn't care whether you kill civilians or not. It doesn't encourage it. It doesn't discourage it. It's just like, oh, if you're trying to attack someone with your blade arms and you happen to cut through, like, 7 people in the process, which is a common occurrence.
Yeah.
It's like, well, that happened.
Just try not to surf on too many of them, like, if you can avoid it. But, you know, things happen, so whatever. I was going to say stealth games in general, I think, are the ultimate power fantasy. maybe something like Dishonored or Deus Ex, specifically, or Hitman, specifically because they both... So if we're talking about power, is like in realistic terms, like the reason like Galciv doesn't feel like real power, even Civilization doesn't feel like real power, is it's very abstract with the lives that you have power over, and maybe a useful definition of when you feel powerful is you feel powerful when you at least recognize some of the relative weakness of the people that you're, you know, exerting power over in some way, right? So if the people of your civilization are just numbers on a spreadsheet, you probably don't feel much power over them because it's just numbers. So maybe to feel that sense of power, you need to have a bit of a sense of the autonomy of the people that you're dicking over. Even if you're ultimately completely in control of that autonomy, or you're able to completely dominate it, they need to have it for you to be bigger than it. I don't know if that makes sense. And I think stealth games do that quite well because you have tremendous amounts of power to take apart an environment in any way you see fit, really. Obviously, you get caught, you might be in trouble, but especially now that games give you more powers, whether that's Deus Ex or Dishonored, to kind of turn any situation to your advantage. Stealth games also encourage you to look really closely at the people you're probably about to dick over, to like watch their patterns and listen to their conversations and stuff like that. And it's that combination of things that I think make them such potent power fantasies, because you have the sort of the sense of the interiority of the adversaries, whatever, whoever they are, but also all this power to manipulate them, and sometimes manipulate them on that basis, like trick them into believing things and so on. And that for me feels more like power than, say, a game where you have the best guns and you can get into a big firefight with loads of people, because that it's power, but it's arbitrary in some ways. I don't know. I don't know if that's necessarily fully sensible, but yeah. Pip.
Am I allowed to talk about Katamari?
Yes, absolutely. Because it's great.
It's a forbidden game though.
That's all right. We can have the forbidden K.
For me, pretty much all games have the capacity to go horribly wrong. And so it's very different with the Katamari games, because with those, you just know it's a matter of time before those things can get crushed by you into a ball. And, you know, so rather than in the normal way of video games kind of thinking, oh, well, you know, I'll encounter you later, or I wasn't supposed to go this way, or, you know, things, I'll try and play it properly and maybe I'll fuck up and maybe I won't, or, you know, I guess I'm not used to feeling powerful. But then with Katamari, there's a kind of, I will start small, but eventually all of you will be under my power and I will roll you up and you'll have to just deal with it. And so, you know, you'll sort of, you'll be waggling around on the ground trying to pick up, I don't know, a paperclip and a bit of discarded Lego, and you'll run into a cat and you'll be like, I'll be back for you. You know, you may be a bit big for me now, but just you see, I'll roll you up and I'll roll up your friends and I'll roll up your house. And then you get a bit drunk with power and then you start rolling up whole universes, and that's all right. But yeah, the rest of games is awful. You know, it just feels so powerless and so, you know, able to be squashed or confused or lost or trodden on.
Aww.
I mean, you know, even those games of Dota, when you sort of... Actually, that's one of the other things I quite like, is something like maybe playing all random, all mid in League. Getting put on a hero that you really, really shouldn't even be getting kills on, because they're like a hard support. But then because everyone's dicking around in that particular game mode, just going sort of 35 kills, no deaths, and maybe 3 assists, and just sort of, you just really shouldn't be doing anything like that, and just feeling really powerful just because you outplayed the other people who weren't taking it seriously. Yes.
Finally. Rob writes, "Dear Fate and Augur, with everyone panning, zooming, and swiping on their phones these days, the time is ripe for a cheap and silly-looking input method for PC games. A mouse in each hand. Am I miles behind the curve, or have I just cut myself on the bleeding edge?"
I have wondered about this many times in my PC gaming career. Couldn't we have 2 mice? I don't know of any system that actually... of any setup that makes it work. Like, you can certainly plug 2 mice into the same PC, but they both control the same cursor, so they just fight each other, basically. I want to bet, though, that there is a PC game that can do it. Like, I think there's no reason... I don't know.
A lot of 5 games use both of your hands as cursors.
Yeah. Yeah, there's no, like, sort of game design reason that can't work, but there might be like a Windows level hardware reason that it will never accept 2 mice as independent things. Like, they all have to be controlling the same cursor.
That would be typical, wouldn't it?
Well, so you can
Windows installing a sloth on my PC without my say so. The shits.
I remember when the Steam controller was announced. One of the things is like you can have like 16 of them in the same PC.
Sloths?
No, 16 Steam controllers.
Oh, okay. Sure.
No sloths involved in this part of the story. And I remember thinking, oh, that's great, because this is going to be like my mouse replacement thing. And so that's basically like I have 16 mice. And I don't think you could actually feasibly use 2 Steam controllers as one person. But those control cursor. So, no, I still don't know. Well, if those control cursors, and you can have them separate inputs in games... Surely there's a way to have 2 mice as separate inputs in games.
What would you do with them, do you think? Like, what motions would it involve? Because I know that this is probably the worst way of thinking about this, and that maybe you would be trying to click different things and maybe stretch shapes, or, you know, maybe use the cursors to poke a foe in the eyes at the same time or something. But my first thought was that you would pick up the mice in your hands and then bang them together like what? A kind of, you know, like how you have 2 halves of a coconut when you're at primary school and it makes the sound of the donkey in the nativity play, you know.
Is not their most sophisticated function. Please make a noise. You actually can do that even if the mice aren't plugged in.
I think it's because my default status with like weird controllers is to think of Donkey Konga, and part of that was clapping. You know, you'd hit the sides of the bongos and you'd hit the tops, but there was also clapping, and it would recognize the audio input. And so I just thought maybe there would be a game where you pretend to be one of those monkeys with a cymbal or something.
New $69.99, the Razer Coconut Heart.
I don't know. I feel like I've exposed myself to ridicule now.
I would love to play like something like Hotline Miami, where one mouse is direction of movement and one mouse is direction of attack.
Might as well just play a twin stick shooter, because that's exactly how that works.
Yeah. Like, I also feel like a 3D space shooter must have some use for this, because that's where there are more degrees of freedom than you have degrees of input, right? Because you can...
I think maybe the weakness of this is that a lot of what you would do with this has already been done with a pad that has 2 analog sticks. And that's a lot easier and more intuitive for people. Like, I'm trying to think of a use for 2 mice.
You could be a chameleon, because they can move their eyes independently. So each hand would control the camera, but the camera would be each different eye from the chameleon. I haven't sorted out the rest of the game yet.
How do you reconcile the fact that your human eye would then have to look at 2 different screens?
But it would be like a day in the life of a chameleon.
But you...
Oh man, you could do it in VR and actually project different images to your 2 eyes.
You move your hands apart and immediately throw up yourself inside out.
Or you could direct traffic. Maybe? Or like planes.
You could do that in VR.
Or, yeah. But I mean, I'm just trying to help.
No, I know. It's...
I feel like a dual mouse setup comes like too early. No, wait. Too late to be of use to mouse users, and like it's going to be obsolete, made obsolete by VR, basically. And it was like too soon for it to happen to mice, and yeah, too late to get in before VR.
Yeah, there's an early version of VR where you have a mouse in each hand and you look like even more of a dickhead.
So it was just really to replace pointing at things, wasn't it? Like, yeah. It was because computers don't understand the rudiments of pointing at things with your hand. So you had to invent a special tool do the pointing.
Yeah. VR could have been invented like before the mouse, and then we would have just physically pointed at the screen. So this is like, what I want, this word here.
Yeah. So with a normal computer, you just don't need, because, you know, who points twice? Like... Maybe, well, you know, like, you don't point with both fingers unless you're doing, like, a kind of finger guns
yeah.
thing.
Yeah, it would have, like...
Who wants to click OK? This guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it would allow you to, like, double fav things.
Yeah.
Like, the Fonz fav. I don't know. I don't, I mean, it's, I don't know if it's a good or a bad idea. It's just an idea.
I still like my coconuts. I think that's a good idea.
You can. I could just get you two halves of a coconut.
But where would you find them?
Sainsbury's. A shop, Sainsbury's.
They don't sell hot. Oh, you buy a whole coconut, yeah. Obviously.
This is the amazing thing about coconut, is it contains both coconut
and two halves of a coconut. But how would you cut it in half really, like, neatly?
Get a saw.
But then you'd lose all the milk.
No, you have the milk separate. We have the milk first.
Yeah.
You can put a skewer into one of the holes at the end and drain the milk.
I'm saying is more than... two mice for a computer game, this
when
coconut...
When did you last see a coconut in a supermarket?
I don't know.
They're there, I think.
I mean, what I'm saying is...
It's all coconut water now.
Civilization to this point has afforded us the tools to solve the problems you're describing. With a minimum loss of coconut milk.
Are we still talking about mice?
Ostensibly, yes.
Okay. Maybe.
Hmm. I would say he's...
What was the question?
I don't know. He says, am I miles behind the curve or have I just cut myself on the bleeding edge? And I'd say sort of neither. You've just sort of described an alternate curve that we've then subsequently tripped over.
I've got two monitors. Maybe I should have two mice.
Yeah.
That's true. Quite good. I actually do work that way at work because I have a PC and a Mac and I have two mice on the same mouse pad. Really confuses people because my Mac is like quite far to the right and my mouse for it is like 2 meters away on the left and I just turn in a weird way. It really confuses the IT people because I'm both left-handed and that doesn't make any sense. So
in my lounge now, I have a laptop on my lap, which has a trackpad, and then also plugged into that is a sort of wireless trackball. And then on the table in front of me is a mouse, which is connected to a laptop, which is connected to my TV. And then connected to my TV is, well, not connected, but linked to my TV is two remote controls.
This is like a really, like, wired article-friendly version of the hip bones connected to the like,
yeah.
thigh bone. But, like, what's the thing on a laptop in the middle of the keyboard? That weird waggly nipple.
The waggly
what
nipple.
Is that? Is that an extra mice?
Yeah.
An extra mouse, rather.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a shitty thumbstick.
But is it just for, like, just in case your track pad
Some people
breaks,
just love the nipple.
Like... You don't see them anymore. But it was
they
like,
used to
be
like
fad.
ThinkPads and stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, that was a thing then?
Yeah, yeah. Trackpads weren't good back then, and arguably still aren't. And so, yeah, that was an alternative. Because I found...
Before touchscreens, there were nipples.
I've just found that, like, a mouse is so much better than everything else that it's worth just doing whatever it takes to use a mouse. Like,
yeah.
If there's not room for a mouse, well, fuck it. Just put a mouse mat on your thigh. Or, like, I have a laptop that's big enough that to either side of the trackpad, the blank space I can use as a mouse mat to just put a fucking mouse on there.
Have you ever used a writing pad, like a tablet?
Yeah, I own almost every input method for a PC because I have RSI, and so I'm always looking for ways to avoid it.
Mm.
And those don't work the way I thought they were. I thought it was like touching the pad was almost like touching the screen, and you'd sort of like put it where you want it to be. But basically, like, they start moving the cursor before you touch them to the pad. Like, they sort of project like a little laser out or something, and it senses that. And then when you touch, that's kind of clicking. And so I find it quite hard to control.
It can be. I think you can alter some of the input on some of them. Like, you know, some of them have like a little switch on the side that you can use, or, you know, like some of them have like a nib at the end that you can press in, kind of almost like a double click. But yeah.
I should install it. I should set it back up again, actually, because I do sometimes need to draw things.
And that is all that we've got time for. I would mention quickly that we received a long and interesting essay, really, from Discord friend Kane about the Rimworld Dwarf Fortress comparison that we recklessly made on the last episode of the podcast. It is genuinely interesting. What I will probably, he also linked to a similar essay, genuinely an essay this time, by Veer Seraph from Discord. I will find some way of putting links to one of them and maybe just like a, you know, text Whitlonger style, you know, text dump of the other in the show notes, because they're a bit much to read out after a couple of beers, because I don't understand all the big words.
Also, Chris is nominated for a GMA at the thing, which we didn't mention.
And so is Tom Senior.
Yes.
Ah. So Tom Senior's in for Game Critic of the Year, and I'm in for Features Writer of the Year. Well, I was originally, officially on the website, I'm down for News Writer of the Year, which makes no sense, because I've never done that job. But that, that was a mistake. I am actually in for Features Writer, which is nice. I have no expectation that that will happen, but always nice to be thought of, particularly because what I do nowadays is edit articles about League of Legends.
Well, indeed.
Anyway, what was I doing? I was ending the podcast. So anyway, if you'd like to send us an episode,
question.
Oh boy, I've been completely thrown by my tangent and then the other tangent. If you'd like to send us a
question,
thanks Tom, for a future episode, you can do so by emailing us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can also tweet us at creightoncrowbar. If you'd like to discuss this episode, or indeed loads of different things, lots of different games and hobbies and so on, then you should join our Discord channel, the link for which is on the website and will be in the show notes for this episode at creightoncrowbar.com. If you would like to follow us as individuals, I'm at C Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N. Pip is...
I'm at Philippa War, which is at P-H-I-L-I-P-P-A-W-A-R-R. There you go, didn't even move my fingers.
I am at Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
Thanks for listening, everybody.